Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Funyuns? Really? Starving. Any idea how long it's been since I ate?
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hilary Busis, here with a special bonus episode as we talk to the showrunner of True Detective Night Country.
Week by week, we've tried to solve this mystery, and now it's time to take a moment to channel our inner Liz Danvers and ask the right questions to Issa Lopez.
So now that we've had a bit of time to digest these epic six episodes, let's hear from the source on how it all came together. Issa Lopez, enjoy the conversation.
First of all, this is so funny. I know we already started, but I'm going to, I didn't know that this existed because I'm being very cautious with the internet and social media.
Why ever intense. Could that be?
I mean, I'm always careless and, oh my God, these last 3 weeks, it's gotten intense. Both on the love, but also on the, you know, it's crazy. Mm. But so I was... Mary Jo, my producer, who I love, she was like, oh, are you listening to the Vanity Fair? And I was like, oh, is there a... I didn't know. So today, not realizing that we were going to do this, I clicked and I started listening and I was like, oh my God, they're getting everything right. I loved it.
We missed
so it's
a couple
great to meet you.
Yeah. Oh man, well, Chris and I were just talking about feeling like we were studying like right before we talked to you, just like for a test. And hearing you say that we got everything right, like...
A pluses, that's huge
yes,
for us.
As a pair of overachievers.
We really needed to hear that.
All we wanted, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, Issa, it's so great to have you here. We're so excited to really break down the season with you. Maybe we could start with something that I actually noticed after we recorded the first episode of this podcast. So I've been doing a list of Easter eggs, keeping track of them for VF.com that I've been updating after each episode. And when I rewatched the pilot, I came across something that totally blew my mind once I realized it, which is that Raymond Clark, the character, shares his name with an actual murderer, mm-hmm. an actual scientist who actually murdered a woman named Annie, a fellow scientist at Yale and was convicted for her murder and is currently in jail. And when I saw that connection, I was like, I don't even know if I can write this down because it feels like a spoiler. But obviously, if you Google it, you can find this out. So, yeah, tell us about planting that in there.
I think I learned about it after the episode aired.
Oh, really?
No way.
That's a coincidence?
That's a coincidence?
That's a fucking coincidence, man. I read about it and I was absolutely first of all, you know, that that could happen. What are the chances? Number one. Number two, immediately I was worried because, mm-hmm. yes, because it's a spoiler. And because I don't want, you know, I feel that sometimes it's a little ghoulish to take an actual horrible event like this and just put it in a show whose main purpose, even though there is a message in it, is entertainment. But it was airing. I could not go back and change his name.
How did you come up with his name? Was it just like, oh, this is a name of a guy? Like, how did you come up?
No. Every name, you know, it's one of the biggest traps for a writer, because you're writing anything and you go, any character, you go like, oh, I'm going to very quickly just find this name. And then there's 6 hours later, you're still not writing the scene. So what happened with Clark is the name was taken from The Thing, from Carpenter's The Thing. There's a Clark in it. So that's I took the name of an actual Antarctic research scientist and the last name from The Thing, and that's how he was born. Wow. It had nothing to do with a real murder.
So it is a reference, just not to what it might seem like it is.
A reference to The Thing, the movie, but not to the actual murderer.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But that blew our mind. It's spooky. It blew our mind. We both remembered that, you know, that exact case too happening like a decade ago too. So it's still present in our brains.
I mean, I'm going to say that it's not absolutely that impossible that there's a stuff that lives in your skull and you're not aware of, you know?
For sure.
And then you put stuff down and it just is there.
Yeah.
But the fact is, there is a Clark character in The Thing, so I think it's just by chance, which is spooky, I would say.
All right, so maybe we should move back a little bit further and just talk about your conception of the season and its arc. I mean, something that we've talked about on the podcast that us and Richard are all very, you know, admiring of is how tight it is and how, you know, there are clues sprinkled throughout. You really can solve the mystery by watching closely from the beginning, although all of us were surprised by the ending. But yeah, tell us, when did you figure out who your murderers would be? At what point in the process?
Oh my God, moment one. You know, I knew that the men had disappeared and it had to be because they had done something terrible, right? It had to be. I'm very, very fond of Greek tragedy. And the undoing of the hero is always ambition and sometimes generosity. I think that the tragic mistake is more interesting when it comes from an ambition to do good. And I conceived this around the deepest end of the pandemic. And I remember that I was watching Elizabeth Holmes' documentary, and they had a philosopher talking as one of the talking heads, which I had never seen in a true crime thing. And the guy was saying, it's kind of a disease, the feeling that you have a mission to do good.
Was that the Errol Morris documentary?
Yeah.
It was.
Yep.
And when you have a mission for the greater good, nothing will stop you from doing horrible things. And I was like, oh, yes, scientist, blah, 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 together. And then I knew that justice had to come to them from what they would do. So in my initial 3 pages that I always write to myself in order to sit in front of a studio and tell them what the story is about, I knew exactly who had done it.
It's so fantastic. I mean, we guessed who the murderer or murderers were. And for them to be women from the community, you know, they're in every frame. They're there from the beginning. They're on the margins of society. And we're sort of taught, and it's sort of an indictment of the viewer, that these women are on screen. They're there. They're in the community. And yet we don't assume it's them because we don't center them in the story in the same way that we center other characters or
Jodie,
white men.
Jodie Foster said that.
And Jodie Foster
when
really
we were talking to her. Yeah, that it's, you know, a kind of a commentary on implicit bias in the viewer as well.
Yeah, which is
the fact is we don't pay attention to certain people, and that's exactly what the series is about, and that's exactly the cardinal sin that hopefully the audience will make too. And that was the ambition from the beginning. It's be the character, the woman that we meet in the crab processing plant at the beginning. And then we meet again with Danvers. Danvers asks her, did they talk to you? What did they say when they talked to you? And she says, without even looking at camera, she says, talk to us. We're the cleaning ladies. Mm-hmm. You know, and we have the woman at the cashier in the supermarket, and we have the receptionist at the mine, and the woman that washes the dishes at the police station, and the woman that cleans at the hospital. And all of these women that we don't pay attention to, as happens with the victims of these crimes, are the ones that had enough and decide to change the story.
Richard was kind of holding close to the theory that the scientists had maybe hit a vein of like some kind of chemical or gas or something that like accidentally drove them crazy. And then they, you know, killed themselves because of that. Did you consider like making the nature versus humanity metaphor, I guess, like more literal in some
way? Well, I didn't. there is another series called Fortitude that I really like the first season. But there's constant the comparison between the two of us. I think the two series are very different other than the setting, you know. Mm-hmm. But I felt that, number one, it would make us super close to Fortitude. Mm. Number two, it felt a little science fiction-y. And though it's not, though the truth is the permafrost is melting and stuff is coming out of it. That is happening.
Yeah.
But rather than make it into a science accident, I thought that it was a great occasion to make us the villains. Not villains, and the heroes too of the story, both the scientists and the women. So I was very, very sure of that idea. That said, there were some notes that I got both from producers and the studio suggesting if I wanted to consider that option. Mm. But it was never part of my plans. Mm. I do love, however, to see how it's emerging. Mm-hmm. Amongst many other amazing theories, because it's just so much fun to see the theories emerging.
Do you have a favorite fan theory now, looking back on it, that you can be like, that was really crazy, or that was so off?
You know what's
or like,
so
what if
funny?
I had done it like that instead?
Yeah. So far, I haven't done that. Mm. Again, I'm just putting my little toe into social media and then pulling it out, because it's heated, yeah, out there.
Toxic, some might say.
Yeah, yeah. But I will say, for every, I don't know, probably 18 love letters that I get, there's two. And I save them because it's like, whoa, that's coming from a really, really lonely, sad place, my man.
Very lonely. But, lonely is an operative word there, yeah.
Yes, yes. But anyways, I do put my toe, and so far not a single one has been like, oh, that would have been interesting. But what I find right this second super entertaining is the obsession that people are developing with the color blue. Mm. There is a whole thing about, there's a lot of blue in the art, and the photography style that Florian Hofmeister, the DP, went for, and at the same time that working with what Daniel Taylor, the production designer, did, comes together pretty blue, which makes sense because the first season was very yellow, mm, and very ochre. And there was a yellow king in it. Mm-hmm. And this is very blue. Bear with me. Yeah, the crab factory, is called the Blue King. Mm-hmm. There's nothing beyond that. But I love it that people picked up on the yellow season having a yellow king and the blue season having a blue king. And the Blue King Crab Factory is also, you know, their sign is in the ice ring. So they're like, oh, it's the Blue King in the blue season. And then Julia has blue hair, mm, and the drawing that Darwin did is blue. And I'm like, that's just so amazing.
We love looking for a pattern.
We love to.
We can't stop ourselves. And blue is also the opposite of orange.
That is true.
Oranges are obviously a recurring motif.
An element in it.
Are the oranges a straight Godfather reference? Is there more to them?
Well, what happened with the oranges is sometimes when I answer these questions, I feel like the evil man that comes into the club and turns on the lights. And I hate that guy, but I'm going to be that guy.
You can, please.
So the orange comes from, there was a scene that I wrote in one of the earlier passes of drafts where Navarro was sent to do a super pedestrian thing in the middle of all of this. I love the idea of Navarro having to do some super stupid job. And because of ice in the roads, a truck of oranges had toppled and there were oranges all over the road. And so she was super bored, picked up an orange. And I'm just writing this scene as happens often. And she throws the orange into the darkness, gets a call, and then the orange comes back. Because those things happen when I write. She's like, of course the orange comes back. And then the orange started to move into the story. Eventually, I caught the scene, but I love the idea of the orange. So I put the orange being dropped by some of the hunters that joined the manhunt. And the moment that I knew the orange was an element and it was going to revisit, I did think of the Godfather because it is the announcement of death coming to us. And it, at the very end in episode 6, she says, my mother loved oranges. So it does feel that she's sending them back as part of her call, of her visitation, of don't forget who's on this side.
Mm-hmm.
It's so interesting. I mean, the orange is a great example of how you play with the supernatural and the spiritual, and yet everything can be explained sort of logically, practically. But still, there were some questions by the end of the last episode. We still don't know. Can you tell us about the tongue?
I knew that was the next question.
How did you know?
I knew it was the next question. So I'm going to give you the two answers, right?
Okay. Ooh, two answers.
Answer number one. No, because I will never give you the one answer. There has to be two for you to choose.
Okay.
I think I was... one of the most formative experiences that I had as a storyteller was Choose Your Own Adventure. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I love those books. Anyways, so one is Danvers, when she comes in episode 2 to Navarro's and says that was Annie's tongue. It was the right DNA. There is some strange damage to the cells in it, and it could be from freezing. She doesn't say it was frozen. It could be from freezing. It's strange, the pattern. So you could assume that Annie's body is found outside the villages in that dumpster that we saw her, and her tongue, you know, Hank did cut her tongue and dropped it as part of the cover up of a warning and using it, the occasion, to actually warn people to not do this because he's working for the mine at this point. So he drops the tongue, leaves the body, and the body is found by, we don't know who, before Navarro is called to the scene. And in this story, what I imagine happened is, it's a community. And one of these women who is called by a child or gets here, takes care of the tongue as a tiny gesture of kindness and reverence for this poor girl, because they know that she's going to be taken for an autopsy. And, you know, the indignities that had already happened are going to continue. So this woman keeps the tongue and they keep it. And when they come into the station, they leave it as a sign of what happened there, right? To give her back her voice. That's one vision. The other one is, you know, Clark knows she's coming back. And she's out there and she's awake and she comes to witness how her women, her sisters, take this man. And she leaves that because so it's
that's
time to tell the story. That's a supernatural.
The supernatural.
Yeah. You decide.
Choose your own adventure.
Yeah. And on a sort of a similar note, we were all kind of obsessed with the character of Rose, Fiona Shaw's character, especially, you know, when she makes that like a beautiful Christmas spread for herself.
For one.
can you tell us a little bit about her and her function in the story and kind of, you know, where you were coming from with her?
It's amazing how it happens when you're writing. At the very beginning, I first wrote the first episode, without knowing a lot of what was going to happen later. I knew the very ending, but I didn't know anything in between. And so it was an old man. His dog comes and the dog goes out and the man follows his dog until he finds the bodies. It was a lot more natural in a way. And then I finished that. That was a treatment. And then I got the green light to make it into script. And as I was making it into a script, I thought that it would be amazing that that's a visitation, possibly, that takes the character there. And then I thought of Ross Cole's father. Mm-hmm. And who was this man and what was his story and if he had a lover. And the next question forever is, if I'm going to make a survivalist woman, the question that I ask constantly of myself when I'm writing, of every scene, of every character, is how can we make this surprising? What is the part that I won't necessarily see coming when I see a survivalist woman in Alaska? So, and by the way, I did watch a lot of documentaries about, the National Geographic living below zero, all of those things. And there's a very specific type of women that live alone up there. And the last thing you would expect of them is to be some scholar that has disappeared from the world. But that's the other side of Alaska. It's a place where people go to disappear. They do. So I thought of how much fun would it be to have Susan Sontag, because that was my constant reference. And when I told Fiona, she was like, oh, I read at her funeral.
Oh,
and I was like, oh my God, this was meant to be, And our whole thing is, what would happen if Susan Sontag stood up one day and said, fuck all this, and took nothing with her except all of her books and moved to Alaska? You know, and that's Rose.
Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment when we return more with True Detective showrunner Issa Lopez.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheik.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
At eBay, you'll always get that feel of real because your fashion purchase will be backed by authenticity guarantee. Whether it's an it bag, a must-have watch, dreamy jewelry, or fire sneakers and fresh streetwear, every step will feel authentic, every flex will feel real. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal with eBay Authenticity Guarantee. Visit ebay.com for terms.
I love that you brought back up season one, and clearly there are all these allusions to previous True Detective, specifically season one. With the spirals. In the last episode, we get the line, "Time is a flat circle."
Someone once told me, "Time is a flat circle. Everything we've ever done or will do, we're going to do over and over and over again."
Can you tell us, how did you sort of find a way
to naturally incorporate that. And also was HBO like, you have to have at least 14% references to the first season. Like, no. Is there a missive that you have to hit?
They were like, you do you, do whatever. Mm. We love you, do whatever. And I was, you're taking something precious. And you sort of expect it with a set of instructions, right? They were like, no, it's yours. And I was like, but does it need to happen in 2 times? It's yours. But do we need to? It's yours. Like, okay. So I didn't start off saying like, oh, we're going to have the references. I did love the idea of, once I decided Alaska was a place, the fact that Rost's father had died there. And it was a Texan survivalist that had come back from the Vietnam War, not okay, and then become a survivalist in Alaska, and that Ross himself had lived there. And it was, why not brush on that, right? And so when I had the ghost for Susan Sontag, Rose, I was like, oh, can I make the time frame work with the ages? And and it did end up working. With tight, but worked. So once Rose, Travis Cole, wasn't it? I knew that there was a sign that would connect the Night Country. You know, we think that the Night Country is Ennis, but there is a Night Country below Ennis that where truly never, ever the sun shines. It's forever night. And that's the cave system. And I love the idea that you see the symbol of the places where, at least in the, if you're going to go the mystic route of the people in Ennis that believe in this mystic side, that there is that symbol of the spiral there. What it is, when we finally find it, is fossils of ancient sea creatures trapped in the ice, and it creates that spiral. The fish died in that shape because there is that force in there, or because the fish were frozen in that shape. And for centuries, the lore of the town knows that that's hidden there. Mm. How is the spiral created? What came first? Is it older than the ice? Or is it just that we've had this tradition for centuries? Up to you once again. But it was so useful because in series one, the spiral marks the rituals and the places that connect with Carcosa. Carcosa being the world beyond, the world where the old gods roam. So it was a very natural thing without having to impose something that didn't belong into the flavor and the mythology that I was creating. And that was the one rule is, nothing is put on the show. It has to emerge from the story that I'm telling. So that happens with the spiral. And the other reference, like the Total United. Well, if I'm going to create an evil corporation, which happens, you know, an all-powerful umbrella situation, why not make it into the very dirty money that is mixed with politics that was established? And all of this is just to say to the people that watch both series, this is happening in the same world. Yeah. This is not a different reality, a different United States. It's the same world where those events happened, for us to create a same universe where the two stories happened. So that's exactly how it happened. Regarding Time is a Flat Circle, I do believe that at least in Clark's mind, Annie died in that cave, but Annie was dreaming about that tattoo, which is the thing that is in the place where she's going to die. So for him, is she always knew that's the place where everything ends and starts for her. It is a cycle, and the spiral itself suggests the cycle. And he's a scientist, and as we know, time flows. Time is a flat circle. If you're going to go down the path of quantum physics. So it just was the absolute natural thing for him to explain, how is it possible that in his mind, Annie has always been asleep in that cave and wakes up every so often. And that's why Otis did find her. in his logic of the events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do also love how when he says that, you see Danvers kind of roll her eyes and be like, oh, this fucking guy. Which is kind of the other side of the original yes. True Detective, which yeah. is like, what is he talking about?
Exactly. Exactly.
not to take it back down to earth very abruptly. But yeah. actually, maybe we should. I'm going to put Chris on blast here and say that he did Google "Are ice caves real?"
Yeah,
when he was watching.
I have never been in one and hope to never be in one.
But yeah, we spoke to Jodi, as mentioned. She talked about how difficult it was shooting her underwater scenes. Can you talk a little bit about the filming of the finale and, you know, the ice cave sequence and the underwater sequence? It seems very technically tricky.
Yeah.
Oh my God! This is one of those things that you write, and as you're writing it, the filmmaker that you are is kicking the writer. Like really, I was being kicked in parts of my soul that usually don't get kicked. Like how do ice caves? You know what is going to entail that, especially the ice caves, the underwater. I've done it many times in my work, and it's tricky, but you can do it. It's tough. Even for super well water trained actors, as Jodi discovered, I'm sure she told you. But if you rehearse and you have the whole support system, it really works, and it worked for us. The main challenge of the underwater was that it had to be underwater in the dark. Mm-hmm. And how the hell do you see that? That's what we dropped the flashlight into the water, but we had to time the flashlight with Jodi with weights. And there was a diver, obviously, to bring her up. But in the dark, even though she knew, and she's such a veteran of many other things, that there was someone there waiting to bring her back to the surface. The moment that you're let go in water and you're weighted down and you just go down, there's something that happens in your body that hits panic immediately. Which looked great in camera. But I was really suffering effective. For her. I was, because she was like, oh, this is nothing. Oh my God, no, I've done this many times. You should keep my hat on so the hair doesn't, like, so in control. And then when she went in, and I had this feeling, and we brought her up, and she comes to the surface, and I was like, Foster, are you okay? And she was like, yeah. Are you really okay? And she was like, it's horrible. And I was like, I know, do it again. It was tough. The ice caves, though, there are ice caves. There's beautiful, beautiful, insane, incredible ice caves in Iceland. It's impossible to shoot in them. I mean, you can do one shot, but not an entire damn sequence of people getting lost in ice caves. So my production designer, he genius, then... I was like, how are we going to do this? We had done scenes in caves in a work we had together. It was just caves. And he's one of the very few production designers that can fake a cave, because fake caves look horrible in cinema and TV, like horrible.
Just very obviously fake. Yeah.
So, but he had done it beautifully with the stone caves before. Now, ice is a completely different thing. And I was like, I need to learn to know if we can do this, or I have to seriously rewrite this thing. And he was like, we can do it. And then finally, when he walked me down his fake caves and I saw them through Florian's lens, because it was also about the lighting, I was like, we're going to be able to wing this. And yeah, voila, we have ice caves.
You could have fooled me. They were amazing.
I know.
It's so interesting talking about the water scene. I mean, that scene is so gorgeous. And water obviously plays a big part in the series. We have Julia, you know, walking into the water, into the ocean. And then we noticed, you know, upon reviewing the series, that Kwavik is reading a Virginia Woolf novel.
Oh, no. He's reading Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Sorry. He's reading Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which there seems to be some, you know, a parallel there between, you know, Virginia Woolf and her death and Julia as yeah. well. How intentional was that also?
A plant.
That's amazing. No, but I wish it was. But I so wish it was.
Okay, so with our crazy cork board, sometimes we're reaching too far.
But I love that it is. I mean, the decision of him reading Virginia Woolf was on purpose. The selection of the books in the different sets was serious, because normally they are the prime and they're brilliant, but they just put books. you know? And I knew that because of the nature of this show, if it worked the way we wanted, which it did, people was going to obsessed. And those
people are going to like freeze every frame. Mm-hmm.
So the books, for example, in at Cavix and Julia's, I wanted them to be smart people books. I was like, don't bring me, I'm not going to say titles, but it's not self-help. It's not beach reading. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, same as Rose. Rose is, oh my God, you know, the books that Rose reads are smarter than anybody on that set, starting with. The only person that is smart enough for that is Fiona Shaw, I will say. So with Kavik, Joel JD, who's delightful to work with, he actually wears glasses, which is so against type of, and again, anything that is surprising, I love. So he would bring his glasses to read the script, and I was like, please keep the glasses for the scene. It's so amazing. So, and then we'd be like, not the type of folk you would expect, a bar owner. In Ennis, Alaska, a burger joint is not a bar. In Ennis, Alaska, to be reading. So why not? Mm-hmm. So that was it. But it was not a reference to Virginia Woolf. I wish it was. You just made it.
It works that way. Yeah. I noticed a Blood Meridian at Salal too, that one seemed intentional. That speaks so like clearly
that is
to the themes.
Very intentional.
Yeah. The themes of the
season.
That's
very intentional. And yeah, it's a collection of boiler, you know, it's the video games they play, the movies they watch, the books they read and the music they listen, which I will say are not that different from my tastes. You know, I love Meridian is, what can we say? But the themes in Blood Meridian are connected to the themes in the show.
The series is so economical, as we've said, and everything gets used and has a purpose. Is there anything that you weren't able to fit in, any scene or any sort of storyline that you wish you could have teased out a little bit more?
Any darlings you had to kill that you missed?
Let me think. I'm sure. But I will need to think about it. I mean, the other thing is I probably suppressed the memory because it's so painful. So painful. But yes, it's, you know, you're telling an A story and a B story, which is two murder mysteries. And then you're also the way that I treated the past, the history of these characters is also a mystery that I reveal slowly. So you only have so much space. And then I try to give the side characters as much life for them not to be paper thin. You know, in the first treatments, Peter Pryor was just a delivery of information, you know, the guy that gives you the guy that checks on the computer and brings the information that my characters needed. And that felt like cheating. So I gave him a life and a tragic twist and all of those things. So there's only so much space that you can have. There's masses of history of who these characters are that is not in the story. The whole Danvers past of a very strict religious father and old brothers and her history of trying to escape an old male house by joining the police force in Alaska. And then there's, we know a little bit more of Navarro's past. There was a relationship of the mother walking out to her death and seeing that with the two girls. And there is one tiny spot in Northwest Alaska that is a desert. It's insane. And it's a very, very dry, very, very dead desert in the middle of the tundra. And I had this vision that the mother walks into that desert and that's where she dies. And that would connect with the dead soldier in the desert that she remembers from Iraq. So the relationship in that desert that ate her mother and gave her the revelation of God. Those are the kind of things that I had to, like the poetic level, I had to drop some stuff to stick with the story.
Mm-hmm. To take it back to Danvers and Navarro, you know, the series ends with the two of them. You know, their relationship, it seems like, has sort of healed. They have an ongoing relationship, at least. I mean, where you leave them, Do you think they're going to be okay? I'm
like, we want them to.
Yeah, I'm worried about my friends, Liz and Evangeline.
Yeah,
like, I know. And you know, I dance a lot around that answer because I hate to give you my full conclusion because I think that there is a space for each member of the audience to fill in the blanks. And that has to do with who you are and what you carry, in a way. I also want them to be fine. Very much. I think it's a love story, not romantic, you know, but it's absolutely a story about two people that understand each other deeply, in spite of their profound differences, and are good when they're together. But the differences end up pulling them apart, and those differences end up putting them together. They end up saving each other. Navarro comes back from there in that desert to rescue Danvers, and Danvers comes back from the dead because Navarro brings her back and gives her the peace with Holden's words in the end for them to be able to finally move away from the past that they've been trying to escape instead of turning around, embracing it, and be able to move on. This sounds so corny. But it is the way I feel. And I feel that they're very evolved characters at the end of that. And it's funny because I did get the question at some point if there was a season two of Night Country, which would be a massive departure of the True Detective structure, let's call it that. But the truth is, I don't think there is any possibilities of doing Day Country. Now we will do it all by day. because the characters have evolved. And I don't think it's as interesting to see a Danvers that understands her feelings and is at peace with them. And I don't think it's as interesting to see a Navarro that has embraced her dark side and it's okay with it. You know, once the characters overcome, you should let them go, I feel.
So if there might not be or may not be a True Detective Day Country or a follow-up to this specific iteration of True Detective, are you working on a new project? Are you thinking about your next project? Are you fully still immersed in True Detective Night Country land?
No, I can't get rid of Night Country quite that easily. You know, it can, like, there's the very last phrase of the series is no one ever leaves, and it feels true right now. but that said, I am deep into working into a next incredibly creepy thing.
Ooh, that's a good tease. I mean, speaking of no one ever leaves, that kind of reminds me of the very passionate True Detective fans who, I don't know, don't seem able to kind of let go of season one. And it feels like they, I don't know, there's this whole subset of people that are very dedicated to being against anything, like, on any True Detective that is not exactly that. Like, what is it about this franchise, do you think, that attracts that kind of, like, fervent, I don't know, that fervent devotion?
Well, first of all, it was really good.
Yeah,
that's
an easy answer.
Was, you know, yeah. I mean, it was really good in its own way. It was its absolute own beast, and it really touched a nerve with a very specific sector of the audience. You know, I think that there is a disillusioned audience member that many of us who feel that this world of appearances has absolutely jumped the shark for all of us, and we feel a lot like Ross Cole punching beer cans and saying, "I know the truth." And I feel that we all have that person inside of us, and it just spoke to a bunch of people very powerfully. I do love the fact because I love that series a lot, and this was done out of love to that series. Otherwise, I would have never taken the job. And I do love the fact that so many fans of the first season are so excited about this one, but not all of them. And that was going to happen. I knew it from day one that not all of them, and they were not going to just quietly go like, oh, they made it into something else. Mm-hmm. But that said, they're watching, which is super, so much fun. I thought they were going to watch one or half of one and turn it off, but they're watching. So something in here is either, is really calling, you know? So I hope in the end, they're kinder to exploring a different angle of it. And if not, well, I had a lot of fun making it. And there's a lot of people watching that are enjoying it enormously, so...
Yeah, I guess you can't focus on the negative when there is so much positive.
Absolutely. Yeah. How has that extended? Have you anybody involved in the previous iterations of True Detective? Have you talked to any of them, or you know, either the cast or the crew or creator?
Not with Nick nor Matthew nor Woody. I never met any of them. But I do know that Anonymous Content, who developed this, they saw the series and mine, and they loved it. So that felt great. My hope here is this was done not because, you know, HBO wrote me a massive check and I took the job. That's not how I work. It was done because I love what they did. I love what they did, and I think that three seasons, not only the first season, but three seasons of exploring the male psyche and the male disillusionment and the desires and the obsessions, and it was really well done. And after three seasons of that, I think it's so much fun to try the same thing with the female psyche.
Yeah, so
and
if you,
I do
yeah.
trust if that you're, someone yeah. is going to be curious.
I'm curious, yeah. Where do you think this series goes from here? Like, what would you want to see in a season five of True Detective?
That's a question for HBO. because I have my ideas, but we'll see.
Fair enough. I'm curious though. You said that you're working on something new that's creepy. You're not like done. You're not like I spent 2 years in the darkness and now I want to like do something fun.
No, you know, it was so weird when I finished this. That I just felt that there was a way to go deeper into the dark. You know, it was like, this was interesting, but what if we take this route?
So it's like at the center of the earth.
Yeah. All the way down. You know what? Well,
yeah.
I, for one, will absolutely follow you into the dark and can't wait to see.
You'll follow Deep Sea Baby?
I will follow Deep Sea Baby. Yes, I will. I will follow you. But wow, thank you so much, Issa, for coming on to the podcast.
Yeah, it's a really fun show to talk about.
It is. It's so fun. And there's so many.
Yeah,
you
we could keep going.
So much. We could absolutely keep going, but we'll let you
We didn't even touch on the one-eyed polar bear.
I know. Ugh, who I thought committed the crime at first.
That's true.
Yeah. I thought it was the one-eyed polar bear, and I'm not afraid to say it.
Well, you know, Pryor was with you, you know, in episode two. And that, as I was watching the episode on TV, I was like, yeah, we never really, because he says, ask again, and he says polar bear, and he says polar bear, right? Because after you edit, you learn how they say it. and she says, okay. And he says, came through the door, blah, blah, blah. And then I go, I never really... explain why they just ditched this theory. It's not a bad theory. It's not a bad theory.
I love it. I stand true. With Pryor.
It could have happened. In an alternate universe, yeah. That's exactly yeah. where we were.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Issa. This has been a pleasure.
My absolute joy. You're doing a beautiful job with the podcast. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
That does it for this episode of Still Watching and this season of Still Watching, but don't fear, Still Watching will be back very soon. Our next show, The Regime, starring Kate Winslet, is premiering on March 3rd on HBO. Until then, you can find me on social media at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me at Christris.
And you can find me at Hillabuster. This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next week with The Regime. See you soon.
Bye. You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.